tape. Stand by to roll tape. Roll it.
Distinguished guests, your president has put me in a very embarrassing position. You know, it's been remarked before, historically, oh, that mine enemy would write a book. Sometimes it's bad for your friends to write books. It's a real pleasure to speak before this National Convention of the ADA, Americans for Democratic Action. ADA was set up in January 1947. Those were dark days for the liberal forces in America. But you people had the courage to take up the fight and go forward. You dedicated yourselves to fight for progress against reaction. Against reaction of the right, and against reaction of the left. You helped to hang the record of the 80th Congress around the neck of the Republican Party, and I finished the job. You held firm against fanatical and misguided attacks of the Wallace movement. And since 1948, you've been going down the line for policies and programs in the interest of the people and in fulfillment of the highest values we cherish in this republic. I congratulate you on all the effective work you've done for the cause of liberal government. Now then, I'm going to say something to you. I think maybe we'll please you a little bit. Of course there was a time when it might not have been so pleasant for me to meet with the ADA. I understand that 4 years ago, along about this time, some of the leaders of ADA were engaged in a rather wild fancies about the presidential nomination. I'm told that there was a little poem that gained some currency in ADA circles in those days, and it went like this. Between the Taft and the Dewey, when defeat is beginning to lower, comes a pause in ADA's occupation that's known as Eisenhower. Peculiar part about it was that you were a young political organization and you had not studied the history of conventions. A president of the United States, when he desires and when he wants to be nominated, there isn't anybody in the world can keep his party from same thing is true when he doesn't want to be nominated. I doubt if you will be having any pauses for that particular purpose this year. In spite of various notions about the nomination in 1948, the outcome of the election that year pleased all of us here, particularly me. And it astonished a great many people. It simply astonished a great many people. Mark Twain said in an inscription I have always had on my desk, always do right. It'll please some people and astonish the rest. Well, that's what we did in 1948. We astonished the pollsters and the sabotage press and the opposition candidates, Republican, crackpot, and Dixiecrat. The results were good for the country, even though they set back the science of political forecasting a full generation. I hope it set them back forever. You remember way back, oh, you're too young for that, but you know what happened to the Literary Digest in a certain moment. I like to remember Elmore Roper and his September spasm, which said, no more polls were necessary. Dewey would be the next president. There really wasn't any use to hold an election in November. He's been apologizing about that ever since and trying to get his tall back. Now the time has rolled around again when you folks have the problem of trying to pick and choose a candidate to support. You are not only the ones who have that problem, and I assure you I'm fully aware that it can be a very perplexing problem indeed. But we're lucky in having a number of good presidential candidates in the field. And some of them are here tonight. I'm sure that the ADA will find the candidate who expresses in his philosophy and in his record the things that this organization stands for. Obviously, such a man would have to be a Democrat. Because this is an election year, I would like to talk to you a little bit about politics. I know you are a nonpartisan or a bipartisan organization. I heard it carefully analyzed here just a minute ago. At least I've heard that you have some Republicans among your membership. And I'm sure that at one time was true. I don't know whether it is now or not. I want to ask these Republicans who are in the ADA not to include themselves in any remarks I'm about to make about the Republican Party. When I talk about the Republican Party here tonight, I mean the dinosaur wing of the Republican Party, which unfortunately seems to be in control of that party. They are living in 1896 and 1920. They're made up of the Republicans of 1896 and 1920, and they worship William McKinley and Warren G. Harding. The first thing I will say about the Republican Party, believe it or not, is an expression of gratitude. I want to thank them for the way they helped the Democrats win elections. Under the liberal policies of the Democratic administration, our country has grown strong and prosperous. And this has been true for such a long time now that people tend to forget what things were like under the Republicans. They criticize the mistakes the Democrats make, but they take for granted all the benefits we've brought them. Every 4 years, it begins to look as if the people had forgotten what a Republican administration would mean to the country. And the Republicans go around convincing themselves that they cannot possibly lose the presidential election. I've heard it happen 4 times. But it is just at this point, when things look darkest for the Democrats, that you can count on the Republicans to do something that will save the day. That is, it'll save the day for us. You can always count on the Republicans in an election year to remind the people of what the Republican Party really stands for. You can always count on them to make it perfectly clear before the campaign is over that the Republican Party is the party of big business, and they would like to turn the country back to the big corporations and the big bankers in New York to run it as they see fit. They're just not going to do it. Just leave them alone. The Republicans will manage to scare the daylights out of the farmer and the wage earner and the average American citizen. They always do that. I had the best time I ever had in my life going up and down this country telling the people the truth. And when they found out what the truth was, you know what they did. And I'm here to say to you that when a man in politics, if he is a leader, has the right ideas, the people are willing to listen to what he has to say. It's a matter of salesmanship. And that's the reason the pollsters are wrong whenever you have a candidate who will go out and say what's good for the people. They'll believe him. But you go down the street and meet the first three or four people and ask them, who are you for and why are you for him? Oh, they say, I'm for this fellow because some article in the paper said this and that about him. They don't know anything about him, really. That's really what makes leadership in politics. You've got to go out and sell yourself and what you stand for. And we're going to get a candidate like that, and he's going to win. Now the Republicans in 1948, in that 80th Congress of theirs, they went after organized labor with their Taft-Hartley law. They went after all wage earners by their attacks on the Social Security program. They went after the farmer by tampering with price supports and by failing to provide grain storage. This year, they're at it again. The Republicans think they've been so successful with their campaign of smears and character assassination that they have the Democrats on the run. And they just can't restrain themselves enough to hide their true colors until after the election. They're too impatient. First one way and another, then another, they're going to give themselves away. Take this steel dispute. I'm not going to talk about constitutional issues here tonight. They're before the Supreme Court. I just want to bring out a few facts about the economics of this dispute in the steel industry. The steelworkers came in before a government agency and proved that they were entitled to some wage increases. It was all perfectly fair, clear, and above board. You can look at the figures and you can look at the record and see for yourself. And then it was the turn of the big steel companies. They were asked to agree to fair and reasonable wage increases and to come in and submit their case for price increases if they needed any. But would they do that? Not at all. Their profits, whatever yardstick you want to use, have been running close to record levels. I think that's the reason why they don't want to submit their case for consideration on its merits. They refuse to abide by the rules of our stabilization program. They just come out flatly and say that the government has to give them a big price increase or else, and I think they want a strike. Now, the Republican leadership didn't have to get mixed up in this fracas at all. The Republican leaders could have taken a calm, judicious attitude and weighed both sides and decide where the merits lie. But that's not the way the Republican leaders act. It never is, thank goodness. They rushed into the fray at once. They took it up in Congress, and they made speeches up and down the nation. They demanded 4 and 5 new investigations. They threatened to wreck price control, and they're doing their best to do it. And what's the purpose of all this? The purpose is to preserve high profits for the steel companies and prevent wage increases for the steel workers. That shows exactly where the old guard stands. It shows that their hearts lie with the corporations and not with the working people. It proves that the old Republican leopard hasn't changed a single spot. It ought to serve as a big, glaring danger sign to the voters of this country of what to expect if they turn the administration of the country over to the Republicans, who are now in control of that party. I'm glad to say that there were a few Republicans in Congress who did not join in the hue and cry against the steel workers. Some of them looked at the facts and drew very different conclusions. And one of them did a fine, courageous job in presenting the facts on the Senate floor. That was Senator Wayne Morris of Oregon. The main body of the Republican leaders are doing just what they do every election year. They're making it good and plain to the American people that so far as domestic policies are concerned, the Republican Party is the party of reaction and the party of special privilege, just as I proved in 1948, and the people believe me, and they will yet. And they're keeping pace in the field of foreign policy, too. Day after day, they're making it plain that the Republican Party is dominated by isolationists, the ones described by General Biddle, who don't really believe in international cooperation at all. Today, most of the American people know that the survival of our country depends on our foreign policy. They know that a firm, consistent foreign policy can arise only from a nonpartisan foundation. They know that the leaders of both parties should work together in foreign policy for the good of the country, and that partisan politics should stop at the water's edge. Republicans on foreign policy. That's enough. 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 Republicans on foreign. But just as these wiser heads appear to have succeeded in getting the Republican Party to stand for the good of the country in foreign affairs, a revolt breaks out. And the old, unreconstructed, isolationist wing of the Republican Party sets out in full cry again and scares the people half to death. This happened again just a few weeks ago. Senator Wiley, the ranking Republican member of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, made a speech to the newspaper editors on April the 19th. I went to press conferences with those editors and had more fun than I've had in a long time. He said, there was a great deal in our international relations of which every American could be proud. He said that the Republican Party should not engage in unjustified criticism of our foreign policy, but should play a constructive role. And he asked us all to remember that, and I quote Senator Wiley verbatim, we are first and last of that breed called American. It was a good speech, and it was an honest one. Well, what happened? First of all, the Bertie McCormick sabotaged press jumped on Senator Wiley. They said he'd endangered his country, betrayed the voters of his state, and imperiled his party. Then his Republican colleagues in the Senate went after him. Senator Kaine from Washington, Senator Welker, and Senator Munt, and Senator Hickenlooper from Iowa, Senator Sheffield of Kansas, and Senator Bridges of New Hampshire, and that great one-man grand jury, Senator Ferguson of Michigan. These gentlemen went after Wiley in a pack. They sneered at him, and they jeered at him, and they distorted his words, and they cross-questioned him, and they gave him to understand that this was an election year, and it was the duty of every Republican to attack the foreign policy of his country. They made it clear from first to last, when it came to foreign policy, they were of that breed called Republicans. and Senator Wiley ought to be likewise. In other words, they are Republicans before they are Americans. And there wasn't a single Republican who got up on his feet and said Senator Wiley was right. Nobody ought to be in doubt now. That was the Republican answer to the latest plea from one of their own members for a bipartisan foreign policy. That was their answer to a fellow Republican who dared to stand up and say that our country is doing a good thing when it cooperates with other countries in Europe and in the Far East to hold back aggression. Isolationism is not dead. Far from it. Even if the Republicans get a presidential candidate with a good record in foreign affairs, he will not be able to drown out the raucous isolationist outcries of the rest of the party. And that prospect is beginning to scare the voters, and it ought to scare them. Now we can always rely on the Republicans to help us in an election year, but we can't count on them to do the whole job for us. We've got to go out and do some of it ourselves if we expect to win. First rule in my book is that we have to stick by the liberal principles of the Democratic Party. We're not going to get anywhere by trimming or appeasing. We don't need to try. The record the Democratic Party has made in the last 20 years is the greatest political asset any party ever had in the history of the world. We have been foolish to throw it away. There is nothing our enemies would like better, and nothing that would do more to help them win an election. I've seen it happen time after time when a Democratic candidate allows himself to be put on the defensive and starts apologizing for the New Deal and the Fair Deal and says he really doesn't believe in them, he's sure to lose. The people don't want a phony Democrat. If it's a choice between a genuine Republican and a Republican in Democratic clothing, the people will choose the genuine article every time. That is, they'll take a Republican before they will a phony Democrat. And I don't want any phony Democratic candidates in this campaign. When a Democratic candidate goes out and explains what the New Deal and the Fair Deal really are, when he stands up like a man and puts the issues before the people, the Democrats can win, even in places where they've never won before. It's been proven time and again. We're getting a lot of suggestions to the effect that we ought to water down our platform and abandon parts of our program. These, my friends, are Trojan horse suggestions. I've been in politics for over 40 years, and I know what I'm talking about. And I believe I know something about the business. One thing I'm sure of, never, never throw away a winning program. This is so elementary that I suspect the people handing out this advice are not really well-wishers of the Democratic Party. More than that, I don't believe they have the best interest of the American people at heart. There's something more important involved in our program than simply the success of a political party. The rights and the welfare of millions of Americans are involved in the pledges made in the Democratic platform of 1948 and in the program of this administration. And those rights and interests must not be betrayed. Take the problem of offshore oil, for example. The minerals that lie under the sea off the coasts of this country belong to the federal government, that is, to all the people of this country. The ownership has been affirmed and reaffirmed. In the
the Supreme Court of the United States. Those rights may be worth as much as somewhere between $40 and $100 billion. If we back down on our determination to hold these rights for all the people, we will act to rob them of this great national asset. That is just what the oil lobby wants. They want us to turn the vast treasure over to a handful of states where the powerful private oil interests hope to exploit it to suit themselves. Talk about corruption. Talk about stealing from the people. That would be robbery in broad daylight on a colossal scale. It would make Teapot Dome look like small change. Well, I got a letter from a fellow down in Texas today who's a friend of mine, and he was weeping over what the school children of Texas were going to lose if Texas didn't get its oil lands 9 miles out from the shore. And I composed a letter to him and then didn't send it. I said... school children in Missouri and Colorado and North Dakota and Minnesota and Tennessee and Kentucky and Illinois, do they have any interest in this at all? Evidently not. It should all go to Texas. Well, it's not going there if I can help it. See how the members of Congress from Texas and California and Louisiana might like to have all the offshore oil for their states. But I certainly can't understand how members of Congress from the other 45 states can vote to give away the interest of the people of their own states having this tremendous asset. Just over my head and beyond me how any interior senator or congressman could vote to give that asset away. I'm still puzzled about it. As far as I'm concerned, I intend to stand up and fight to protect the people's interest in this matter. And there's another matter I don't intend to back down on. That's our party's pledge to develop the vast natural power resources of this country for the benefit of all the people. And to make sure that the power produced by public funds is transmitted to the consumer without a private rake-off. How could we back down on a pledge like that? When you look around us at the great good that has been done by the TVA and the Grand Coulee and the Southwest Power Administration, when we see what projects like these have done to improve the lives and increase the prosperity of our people, how could we possibly justify weakening our policy? We just can't do it. I don't care how much money the power lobby puts into this campaign against us. I don't care what lies and smears they put out. There's a principle here which goes to the welfare of the country. And we're going to stick to it, and we're going to win on it. There's another thing we must stand firm on. That's our pledge on the issue of civil rights. No citizen of this great country ought to be discriminated against because of his race, religion, or national origin. This is the essence of the American ideal and the American Constitution. I made that statement verbatim in the speech of March 29th, in which I said I would not run for president, and I hope that speech and this will be the fundamental basis of the platform of the Democratic Party in Chicago. We've made good progress on civil rights since 1948 in the federal government, in the armed forces, and in the states. But we still need the legislation I recommended to the Congress over 4 years ago. We must go ahead to secure for all our citizens, East, West, North, and South, the right of equal opportunity in our economic and political life, and the right to equal protection under the law. That is real, true, 100% Americanism. This is very important to us abroad as well as at home. The vision of equal rights is the greatest inspiration of human beings throughout the world. There is one member of this ADA who can tell us from her own experience how important it is for the world to know that we share this vision. She's been our spokesman on this subject in the councils of the United Nations, and she's done a wonderful job, and that's Mrs. Roosevelt. Part of our fight that's extremely important, that is to protect the civil liberties of Americans. Your national chairman, Francis Biddle, has pointed out the terrible dangers that lie in wait for us if we surrender to the clamor of McCarthyism and adopt the practice of guilt by accusation. We cannot, we will not give up nor weaken on this issue either. I got a great kick the other day out of a headline in an article on the left-hand side of the paper in which it said that a committee in the Congress was going to investigate the Justice Department for browbeating witnesses. Now, I'm not casting any reflection on any good senator or representative, but they'd better investigate themselves on that. These are some of the principles for which the Democratic Party stands and for which the ADA stands. We stand for better education, better health, greater opportunities for all. We stand for fair play and decency, for freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and the cherished principle that a man is innocent until he is proved guilty. Taken together, these principles are the articles of the liberal faith. I am sure that the liberal faith is the political faith of the great majority of Americans. It sometimes happens that circumstances of time and place combine to deny its expression, but the faith is there, and the reactionaries can never hope to have any but temporary advantage in this country. That is why the Fair Deal program will not be weakened or compromised. That is why the Democratic Party will nominate a liberal for president. That is why this time, as in 1948, the ADA will throw its energies into the campaign battle and will carry on the good fight against reaction, fear, and selfishness. And that is why this time, as in 1948, we win.